Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today, we're talking with Phil Cafaro about overpopulation and environmental challenges. North Dakota is the 19th biggest state in the U.S. It's roughly the same size as Washington, and it's bigger than Florida. But while Florida houses 19.5 million people and Washington has 7 million, North Dakota has only about 700,000. If you plan even a little bit, you can go a long time without seeing anyone else. This freaks my mother-in-law out. She's from North Carolina, a smaller state with a much larger population. When she walks around downtown Grand Forks, she likes to ask where all the people are. And my wife always responds, "These are all the people, Mom." Yet even with its smaller size and its 10 million people, North Carolina still has plenty of places where you can hide. Eric Rudolph, the fugitive Olympic Park bomber, lived in the Appalachian Mountains for 5 years before he was apprehended. So with all of this said, it may seem odd to have a discussion about overpopulation, or rather, it may seem strange to assume that it's an American problem. Sure, if we look at pictures of Karachi or Mumbai, we can see it, but that's not here. That's there. There are two responses to the skeptics, but the first is bizarrely unpersuasive. We only have one world, and a problem for one person is a problem for everybody. Why do I call this bizarrely unpersuasive? Because it's true, and we should care. But we don't. America still feels large, open, and available. And since we don't experience it as crowded, we don't act. Philosophers remind us that justification is different than motivation. That just because we know something is true doesn't mean we'll act on it. We all understand that cigarettes will kill us, but people smoke anyway. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And as a result, environmentalists have two different jobs, to persuade us that they are right and to inspire us to do something about it. But these are very different skill sets, and they're usually found in very different groups of people. Here, a philosophical problem is intensified by a practical one. The second response to skepticism about overpopulation is to prove our perceptions wrong, to get us all to doubt our experience of our country as abundant. How can America have too many people if our states have so much land? Here, the problem is that the term overpopulation is ambiguous. We need an independent standard to tell us how many is too many, and that is what our guest today will offer. He's going to claim that empirically, objectively, our environment simply can't sustain the next generation. There aren't enough resources, there's a tremendous natural devastation, and there's less and less wilderness every day. If we don't lower the population, he's going to insist, we're all doomed. I suspect, however, that even our most open-minded listeners will resist his position because there's an even deeper motivation to look away. Accepting facts also means embracing moral responsibilities. Again, philosophers have shown us, time and time again, that once we identify a moral wrong, we're obligated to fix it. This is why the U.S. government rarely uses the term genocide, because once it does, we have to protect the victims. This is also why so many people refuse to say they're sorry after they hurt someone. Once they apologize, they have to make up for the pain. The same is true of overpopulation. Once we accept that it's real, we are faced with some very serious questions about immigration and refugees, about contraception and abortion, about consumption and inequality. And once we ask those, we're faced with even more intimate dilemmas. Which one of our friends do we wish hadn't come to this country? Which one of our kids do we wish weren't born? Of course, we can't rewrite the past, but those unwelcome new Americans, those children that were never conceived, they feel real. They are sacrifices. And maybe this is why so many people refuse to accept that human-caused climate change is real. Once we do, we have to fix it. And fixing it feels way too hard and way too disruptive. The thing is, there is a case to be made that overpopulation trumps everything else, even individual rights. The democratic world has spent much of the last two centuries arguing for the integrity of each individual, but environmentalism may turn us all into utilitarians. It may force us to consider the needs of everyone collectively before we concern ourselves with particular people. So overpopulation is not just a practical problem, nor is it simply political. It's a philosophical dilemma that requires shifting our moral point of view, and that is never easy, even when we have no choice. And now our guest. Phil Cafaro is a professor of philosophy at Colorado State University. He's the author of Thoreau's Living Ethics, Walden and the Pursuit of Virtue, and most recently, the co-editor of the anthology Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. Phil, Welcome to Why.
Great to be with you, Jack.
Today's episode is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking emails, but feel free to join the conversation in our chat room at whyradioshow.org or comment at facebook.com/whyradioshow. So, Phil, I guess I want to start by asking a very basic question. Your book, Life on the Brink, is subtitled Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. But you're a philosopher. What's the difference between an environmentalist and a philosopher who's interested in, say, environmental ethics? Where do you draw the line between the two?
Well, it's a little hard to draw a line. There's an awful lot of overlap, I would say. An environmentalist, in my mind, is someone who cares very deeply about the environment and works to protect it. A philosopher, on the other hand, is, in our world, he or she is an academic of one sort or another who explores sometimes very abstruse questions. For me, a philosopher, too, hearkening back to the older meaning, is a lover of wisdom. So someone who explores the meaning of his or her life in the world and tries to act on that understanding. And maybe that second definition of a philosopher is a little bit more where you might get the overlap between an environmentalist and a philosopher. As you explore your life in this world, you might get deeper into questions about how you should relate to nature and the wider world.
Well, the picture that lots of people have of philosophers, and I don't think our long-term listeners have this experience anymore, but certainly the picture of philosophers that gets portrayed as a sort of detached, objective individual who's interested in the truth, capital T, who detaches their emotions and their individual desires for the search for independent reality. And the vision that people have of environmentalists is a partisan, often ideological, political operative who's trying to pursue their own agenda. Aren't those two visions incompatible?
They can certainly get into very serious tension with one another. But I would say that's sort of like life itself. I mean, we all commit to causes and things that we care about. And we've probably all had the experience of sometime being brought up short when new information shows us that we weren't necessarily on the same path, or at least when new information has shown us that issues are more complicated than we thought. So I guess being an environmental philosopher, it involves a commitment to the idea that as we learn more, that will help guide our actions. So there's a sort of optimism there that we can apply reason to our lives.
This is going to be a theme that I think permeates the discussion. I talked about it briefly in the monologue, the sort of distinction between applying reason and the role of emotion. When you're investigating environmental issues, and your book, Life on the Brink, is full of some horrible statistics, some scary statistics, some positive stories. And of course, I react emotionally to a lot of that. When you're engaged in your philosophical research, if you engage emotionally to a fact about, let's say, the environmental disaster in the rainforest, does that interfere with your work or does that enhance your work?
Well, I suppose it can do both. I mean, I like the idea that our emotions can hopefully give us a sense of what's important in life. But I also think they have to be corrected. Our emotions are of course, very personal. The things that we wind up caring the most about that resonate with us, they can maybe be a function of very particular experiences, and maybe they don't have a wider relevance all the time. I mean, on the other hand, where would we be in terms of how we treat just one another without that very basic experience of compassion and a sense when someone else is in pain that matters? It's hard. I don't know how far we would have gotten in improving our treatment of one another if we couldn't build on those emotions. So as when you're talking about human rights issues, I think with environmental issues, feel those emotions, but then be able to step back and reason about the situation as well.
So part of what you're going to have to do is you investigate these issues, and if you present your research is to balance, to use the emotion to keep people interested, but to find that reason to make an argument, to provide evidence, and to be able to see the difference well. Is that hard?
I think it's hard, although I think most people have some very basic connections that they make to the wider world, and they might do it in very different places. For some people, they climb mountains. For other people, they wade in swamps and look at birds. That's my own favorite way of connecting to nature. Some people have little city parks that for them are green oases in their lives. But I find most people have some basic experiences and emotions around those experiences that you can build on.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about that experience, because your first book is on Henry David Thoreau. And I can think of few philosophers and few books more than Walden that people have passionate and intimate relationships with. People talk about Walden as if it is just the center of their lives. And then there are other people, John Muir, J. Barrett Caldicott, who are famous environmentalists and environmental philosophers, who environmentalists speak with such passion and such love and such intimate revere. And I wonder, is that part of – let's talk about Walden for a second. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the appeal of Walden, that he manages to make these philosophical arguments in the midst of these emotional and intimate connections with nature?
Oh, very much. I think as academic philosophers, you and I are very familiar with setting out abstract arguments, and there's a sense in which we think that's a road to truth. Thoreau and Walden is following a very different path, or at least he presents himself as following a very different path, whereby by digging deeper into exactly where you are and enriching your connections where you are, that's where the knowledge and the wisdom are going to come from. And I think that resonates very powerfully with people.
So it occurs to me, and I want to jump a little further ahead than I had originally planned, but it occurs to me that for those who haven't read Walden in a long time or have never read it, Thoreau sets out to live by himself in a cabin by a lake and records all of the things that he does, including the money that he spends. And while there's some critique, he wasn't that far away and he would have dinner with Emerson a lot. The basic point is still the same. And I wonder, is this a comment on overpopulation? Is his desire to be alone and his sort of ignoring his neighbor and his dear friend Emerson, intentionally disregarding his existence for the book, is this about the effect of other people in our lives and the nature of what personal space is or ought to be?
Well, Thoreau himself wondered about that very question. There's a wonderful passage in his journals a few years before he died where he sort of wonders this. He wonders, is my love of nature, is it necessarily connected to a sort of a coldness towards people? But I think for Thoreau and for most of us, it's a matter of balance. It's just a fact that by spending some time out alone in nature, by setting people aside for a while, you can start to pay more attention to the non-human world. And you can start to learn things about its rhythms and very basic things about what are the birds and what are the plants that are there. So the way I talk about this in my Thoreau study is whatever Thoreau himself got out of that experience, for most of us, who maybe are a little bit more sociable than him, it's more a matter of getting as much as we can out of solitude and out of society. And a good life, the fullest life you can imagine living, is going to be one that makes a place for both and gets the most out of both. I think that's probably the best way to think about it.
You know, years ago, probably in grad school, I read an essay by Emerson called Walking. And as our listeners know, I'm a fairly urban guy. And so it's funny that his essay stuck with me for so long, and I think about it quite often. And he makes this distinction between walking and sauntering. And he says that when you're walking through the woods or when you're walking through a park even, there's a period of time where you're walking and you're not noticing anything. But after a while, you begin to notice the plant life and the trees, and you begin to experience nature. This experience, this philosopher talking about how we discover nature, this is not an isolated incident, right? Philosophers have talked about the human relationship between with nature for almost all of philosophical history. Isn't that correct?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And what are the basic themes? What are the basic ideas when philosophers engage in, I guess, what would be called a philosophy of nature? What kind of thing do they like to talk about? What are the flashpoints?
Well, you know, for Thoreau certainly, and for many philosophers, once you start to think about your place in nature, one obvious question that's going to come up is, how should you treat the non-human world? And that's something that came up very explicitly for him at Walden. Once it was a question of, in order to make his living, cutting down a few acres of trees and planting beans and corn, he started to wonder, well, you know, do I have a right to do this? Because he knew personally a lot of the animals that he was displacing. And now, of course, for most people, this is kind of a crazy idea, right? Of course we have a right to cut down some trees and plant our fields. But for Thoreau, if you really start to understand that there's a whole world out there with many, many other creatures making their way in it, the whole question of you're personally displacing other species becomes important. And of course, that can widen out into the question that we deal with in Life in the Brink, the new book. Are there any limits to how much humanity has a right to displace the rest of nature?
And this also is a question that comes up quite often in environmental ethics class, this notion of what it means to know another species personally, right? I mean, I have a fairly close relationship with my dog.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that I have a relationship with the squirrels or the rabbits, both of which my dog regularly kills. And there are some people, I mean, a lot of our listeners, because we're in North Dakota, a lot of our listeners are ranchers. And there's an argument that comes from many people, not just ranchers, not just hunters, not just farmers, that say things like, the reason why we talk about a personal relationship with another animal is because our experience of bunnies, of rabbits are Bugs Bunny, our experience of ducks is Donald Duck, that we've been Disneyfied and cartoonified. And yet you seem to challenge this notion that you think that being in nature, you do have a personal relationship with another species that is more meaningful. And it's not anthropocentric. It's not about giving them human characteristic. It's about treating them on their own level.
That's right. Or it can be. I mean, these days, it's very easy to live a life that's completely mediated and you don't really have any connection to nature. I mean, most of us work in offices or inside in some way, or we're working in very highly human-dominated environments of one kind or another. So you have to maybe work a little harder even than you did in Thoreau's day to get out and connect to other species. But I do think that you can do that. You can get at the reality of the way other organisms are living. You can learn about it and come to care about it.
And in anticipation to shifting the discussion to population and consumption and these other issues that Life on the Brink talks quite a bit about, I guess I want to ask about the debate amongst philosophers that really sees its height in the 18th century, which is that nature is a resource to be exploited, that nature is out there for us to use as we need. Do environmentalists challenge this perspective, or do they simply say, well, there just isn't as much as we think there is, so we have to be spare with our utilization of resources so they're there in the future?
I think you just named sort of the two main strands of environmentalism. There's the sort of a conservationist strand, which is a very utilitarian and human-centered approach. Yeah, the world is made up of natural resources, but we have to be good stewards of those. We don't want to overexploit them or diminish them through pollution. We don't want to use up all of X, whatever X is. We want to keep replenishing that for future generations. So that is a very important part of environmentalism, and it's very important to any of us who have children and who want to leave resources for them to live good lives as well. On the other hand, there's this other half of environmentalism, which is more about preservation. It sees a sort of independent or inherent value in other organisms. It sees a value in wild nature, and it wants to preserve that. Not everywhere, but where we can, we want to preserve all the other species that we currently share planet Earth with.
This is a topic that actually first came up on the show quite a few years ago when we visited China. This distinction between nature and wild nature, or nature and wilderness. What's the difference, and how important is this distinction?
Well, in environmental ethics, it's really run the gamut between people who say it's a misleading distinction, and everything is nature in some sense, including human beings and our artifacts, and therefore, really, what we just need to focus on is intelligently using the world. And probably the majority view among environmental philosophers, and certainly among environmentalists, is the wild nature distinction is very important. Yeah, there's a larger sense in which human beings are natural. We think, a product of evolution, and we're not supernatural, right? So we create a lot of things, but we're still part of this whole world. But we're a very special part. We bring in intentionality in a way that other species don't. And we're just hugely powerful in terms of our impacts on the globe and in terms of our ability to displace so much else. So for most of us, I think this distinction between nature and wild nature is important.
When we come back, I want to ask you about this concept of intentionality, because I think it's really important. And I also want to ask you why wild nature is important, because then we're going to get directly into the question of overpopulation and consumption and go into the meat of the argument. You're listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Phil Cafaro on Why Philosophical Discussion About Everyday Life. We're talking about overpopulation and asking whether there are too many people for our environment. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm talking with Phil Cafaro and asking the question whether or not there are too many people for our environment. You know, there's this video going around Facebook right now, and I hate talking about videos going around Facebook, but nevertheless, there's this video, and its presentation is really too aggressive for me and annoying, but it's called Solar Freakin' Roads, and it's about – yeah, I guess you know it too. It's about this new invention that these folks have come up with, that where they can put these solar cells on roads to replace the roads, they can handle the weight, they can handle all the things, and that all of our roads become solar collectors for energy. They claim, and I don't know whether it's true, they claim that they can collect three times the amount of energy that the country needs by replacing all the roads. They claim that we won't have to shovel anymore, which is a huge deal in North Dakota. They do make a lot of other claims as well. In the process, they make all these other claims that, well, once we don't have to shovel, we don't have to have big trucks to clear the snow, and we'll save gas, and we'll do all these other things. And there are two things about this the video that strikes me. The first is, if they're even partially true, if this is right in any way, shape, or form, we have the potential for an environmental revolution immediately. The idea that we could use roads as solar collectors, in and of itself, even if they can't do it, is astonishingly revolutionary to me. A brilliant idea that certainly never occurred to me before I saw the video. The second thing that struck me is how immediately people are willing to shoot it down. People didn't seem to give it credit. I mean, lots of people didn't. Lots of people were excited about it and shared it because it's Facebook. But so many people just said, this won't work. Immediately give lists why. And my experience of all of these sorts of discussions is that anytime anyone comes up with a new idea, even if they acknowledge that it's imperfect, everybody tells why it can't happen. So, Phil, I want to ask you to sort of transition back into the conversation. How much of people's reactions against solving environmental problems, against dealing with overpopulation, is just knee-jerk skepticism that has no philosophical value?
Well, of course, when you talk about dealing with our environmental problems, that can make real demands on people. And so I can understand people resisting to some degree. But I think you're right that we need to keep open minds about these questions, whether we're talking about techno fixes like solar freaking roadways, which is a very funny video, or whether we're talking about imagining an economy that isn't endlessly growing or a population that isn't endlessly growing. These are serious issues. They're important to us and our kids and our grandkids. And we need to be willing to keep an open mind about solutions, and maybe we need to be willing to make some sacrifices going forward.
You know, you bring up this question of economy. The first real discussion of overpopulation that I sort of have encountered was Malthus's essay or book in the late 18th century on population, where he says, much to everyone's surprise, that the big problem of the future is going to be overpopulation, that population is limited by our resources. Is there as long a philosophical discussion about overpopulation as there is about nature and human relationships with nature?
Well, you can find mentions of overpopulation in Aristotle, for instance, and in some of the Roman writers. So there have been discussions about the earth groaning under the weight of tremendous numbers of people for thousands of years, even when there was one-tenth the number of people on Earth that there are today. So yeah, there is a long history of this. I would say, though, it's only in the 20th century that you've had it become a sort of insistent and important argument. Yes, people talked about Malthus. He got a lot of press, but the world kept adding people and seemed to be able to do it during the 19th century, whereas the 20th century has really been the century where the human population has exploded. In 1900, we had 1.5 billion people. Today, we have somewhere between 7.2 and 7.3 billion. So that's just an immense change. And rightly, I think, overpopulation has become an important issue.
So given the number of people, and this goes back to what I promised our listeners I would talk about, and I often don't keep that promise, why should we prioritize wild nature? Why is wild nature important if we have so many people and we need to give them a place to live and a place to eat and a place to function? Why should we prioritize wildness as opposed to, I don't want to say civilization because that has so much moral baggage, but as a place, you know, aren't people more important, I guess, is the question.
Well, we certainly behave as if we're more important, and that might be justified. But the question now is really becoming, are people all that's important? I mean, we've already reached a point where we've commandeered a lot of the best land around the world for our direct purposes, and we're grabbing more and more of it, either for direct utilization or indirect use of one sort or another. So in many parts of the world, and in the world as a whole, I think, we've really reached a point where if we do not consciously say wild nature has a value and we need to keep some of it on the landscape and the seascapes, it's all going to be gone. And why should that matter? Well, that's one of the most important questions in environmental ethics. And I could think of two main sorts of answers. One, it might well matter to us. We might lose something very important. Talking in resource terms now, we might lose a very important resource if we no longer have wild nature to explore aesthetically and scientifically and recreationally, etc., etc., etc. And then there's the question of whether there is some independent value in these other species, some independent value in the wild places that still exist. Many of us have argued, I and a grad student argue in this book, Life on the Brink, that in fact other species have a right to continued existence and that it's wrong for people to extinguish them.
What happens when the right of a human being comes face to face with the right of another species or another individual animal or creature or organism to exist, right? This folds into the caricature of environmentalists that's used in American media, you know, save the spotted owl society, right? That they don't care about people, they only care about animals. But there really is a legitimate question there, which is what happens when the two come face to face? I'm thinking about, bizarrely, the Star Wars films, and in the prequels, they go to the city of Coruscant, which is one whole planet, which is an entire city. Now, that doesn't work if you don't have other planets to get resources from, but here is a imaginary people that is perfectly happy living in a full city without wild nature, without anything else. And so is this just, and I'm really going to push you here on the philosophical claims about the importance of other species, is this just a matter of personal preference? Some people like wild nature and some people don't. Or is there for lack of a better term, a deep, persuasive philosophical argument that nature has a value in and of itself that cannot be violated, even if it means sacrificing certain aspects of human existence?
Well, you're asking one of the main questions that environmental ethicists grapple with. And as you know, it's hard to come up with knockdown, drag-out arguments in ethics. And that holds whether you're just talking about interhuman ethics or interspecies ethics. I think there are pretty strong arguments that when human beings take so many resources or so much habitat that we drive another species extinct, that we've taken too much and that we've done something wrong. And I would point out that whatever the arguments are, the United States, in the Endangered Species Act of 1973, made that kind of a moral commitment as a nation. We said that when a species has been driven to the brink of extinction, we need to set aside sufficient habitat and resources so it doesn't go extinct. And we very explicitly said that includes human economic interests. Those should not trump the very existence of another species. Now, you know, why might that be? What's the argument? Well, part of the argument is taking a longer view of life on planet Earth. The United States is what, 230 years old now, 240 years old, something like that. The species that we're talking about here, some of them have been millions of years in existence. They have a long history. The species we're talking about are often very, very beautiful. They are very complex in their behavior and their interactions with one another. The idea that we would snuff that out for perhaps relatively short-term economic gain, it just seems wrong. To some of us, it seems analogous to the idea of the Germans looking for Lebensraum to the east and simply saying, well, those Poles are inferior. We're just going to drive them out and we're going to take all that land. The idea that we could simply drive the buffalo extinct, drive the prairie dogs extinct, drive the passenger pigeons extinct, one after another, and just replace it with more people and our economic life support systems, it seems harsh and imperialistic and selfish.
Well, and this is the core right here of what many people call use the term speciesism, right? That there are some people who will hear your analogy and say that's absurd. There's no analogy between German imperialist advancement and warlike expansion and what we do with the buffalo. But then there are others who say, no, look, the only reason why we think human beings are more important than buffalo is because we're human beings. And that's a form of prejudice. That's a form of discrimination. It's speciesism. And so the core argument here really rests on our point of view about the relationship between human beings and nature, in that we have great disagreements, or people have great disagreements about how to value life on this planet.
We do. We have big disagreements about that. You're right. One qualification I would make in this, to my mind, it's not so much dependent on saying other species are just as important as us. The question is, do they have some importance? So, you know, I was out a couple hours east of Fort Collins here at the foothills of the Rockies. I was out east on the short grass prairie this weekend, bird watching. And, you know, I saw some beautiful species out there, lark buntings and peregrine falcons and just tremendous things. I mean, it was a real privilege to see this beautiful life out there. But I'm not going to say that lark buntings are as important as human beings. What I'd want to say is lark buntings and peregrine falcons deserve a place on this planet. And we can find a way to both treat ourselves, human beings, with respect and create lives that are worth living and leave some habitat and resources for all those other things.
And this, of course, gets us to the next topic of discussion, which is that we're not just talking about overpopulation. We're also talking about consumption, and that part of the issue isn't just how many people there are right now, but how many resources people use. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the relationship between consumption and overpopulation and how by adjusting what we consume, we can also adjust how many people can exist at any one time.
Yeah, it's a very important topic. It's one that environmentalists often kind of get hung up on. People who don't want to look at reining in consumption will sometimes say, well, let's just stabilize or reduce our population. On the other hand, people who are uncomfortable talking about overpopulation will sometimes say, well, look, if we just consumed less, then we could continue growing the population. And I think both of those views are sort of fundamentally mistaken. Our overall environmental impact is really a function of three things. It's a function of how many people we have. It's a function of how those people are consuming on average. And then it's a function of the technologies that we use to further that consumption. So if you want to limit our impacts, environmental impacts, and again, you're going to have to limit them at some point if you're going to leave space for anything else besides people. If you want to limit that, you really have to look at all three of those things. So to get back to your solar roadways earlier, yeah, if that turns out to be a viable technology, that could be put to use to limit human impacts. But on the other hand, it's more likely to be put to use as another tool to just ratchet up higher populations and greater energy use. So you really have to look at all three of these things, the technologies, how much we're consuming, and how doggone many of us there are.
Now, skipping ahead just a little bit to this question of what do we do when we want to reduce the population, because, of course, there's the question of whether or not we maintain the population as it is, and then there's a question of whether or not we reduce the population. This necessitates conversation about family planning, about contraception, about abortion. It also necessitates question. Well, let's stop there for a second. there are people who are going to say, look, already we're talking about the murder of human beings. Already we're talking about the prevention of human beings' existence in the future, because in order to reduce population, we have to limit unwanted pregnancy. We have to limit pregnancies, period. We have to respond to unwanted pregnancies. And in some cases, like in some Chinese policies, we have to encourage, if not force, women to get abortions. And so already this question of overpopulation brings in some of the most divisive issues in our country today. How do you respond to this strong and heartfelt resistance to the idea that controlling population necessitates limiting and sometimes even extinguishing human life?
Well, I think that's the problem. And that's why environmentalists in the past 30 or 40 years have moved away from talking about population. It touches on very difficult questions. And if you're being honest in discussing it, it does say things like, look, we're going to limit our numbers. And I mean, you have kids, I have kids, most of your listeners either were a kid at one point or have kids. And you know, if you've looked at a young child, that there's just something infinitely valuable in that. So there's something, it's just naturally going to be uncomfortable to say you can have too much of a good thing. On the other hand, most of us these days don't have the same large families that people had in the past. Presumably we have reasons for that. I had two children and then I had a vasectomy. Now that kept some wonderful children from existing in this world. And yet I thought it was the right thing to do personally and environmentally. So my answer to this is you just have to wade in and recognize some basic facts. In 1900, there were 76 million people living in the United States, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Today, there's 318 million living there, living here, almost 4.5 times as many. We're bumping up against ecological limits, and that means we have to start reasoning and making some hard decisions about limiting human numbers in the United States.
Is this question of abortion and family planning and the inability for environmentalists to talk about it, is this a political problem or is it a philosophical problem? And what I mean by this is, do environmentalists not want to talk about it because it's politically unpopular, it takes attention away from their cause, they can find other ways to do it without touching on the most divisive electoral issues in the country? Or are there real philosophical divides about the right to have children, the goodness of bringing new children into the world, the role of contraception, the role of abortion? Does this represent a practical problem, or are there real theoretical issues that divide the community?
Oh, I think there are real theoretical issues. Now, the good news is that the theoretical issues come around questions like, if you have some good empirical evidence that a nation is overpopulated, would you be justified in doing what the Chinese have done, in setting limits and punishing people if they had more than one child? It's very easy for us in the United States to look at that and say, that's horrible. Everyone should have the right to have as many children as they want. It's very different if you're living in a society that's choking in its own wastes or where half the young adults don't have jobs. At that point, you might well say, your choice to have children is not just a personal choice. It's also a social choice. And society has a right to intervene there. And that's a very difficult theoretical issue, I think. The good part is that in many places around the world, you can actually have a sort of a win-win solution to this. Instead of going in and forcing people to have fewer kids, in many places, all they've needed to do is go in and provide cheap or free contraception and change some of the social mores around the acceptability of using it and around the value of big families. In countries in Latin America, in South Asia, in the Far East, in many parts of the world, we've seen when people get the opportunity to choose how many children to have, they choose to have fewer children. And that is wonderful because it's a win-win. You're saying we're going to give people more rights to choose how many children to have, and they're going to choose to have fewer. So when that comes together, that's a wonderful thing. And Martha Campbell in our book talks about this. She talks about 215 million women around the world with an unmet need for contraception. If we could simply get them the contraception that they want to use, we wouldn't have to force them to use it. They would use it and, in their own way, have fewer kids. So that's a good thing. Now, when you come to the United States, we've got other controversial issues. U.S. population growth is driven primarily these days by immigration. And that's another reason why environmentalists have run away from population issues in the United States. They're very uncomfortable saying, in order to stabilize our population and limit our environmental impacts, we've got to reduce immigration. But again, that's another issue that we really have to wade into if we're going to take population seriously.
So there's really no way to discuss population control independent of all of the other issues of the day, that immigration, refugees, and of course there are going to be a lot more environmental refugees in the future, family planning, women's rights, all of this stuff gets put on the table immediately once you start really dealing with overpopulation in a serious fashion.
I think that's true.
I want to go back to the question of that I asked in the monologue, because you brought up China and you brought up their policy. And again, I was in China, and there's tremendous amount of land in China. And here in North Dakota, there's tremendous amount of land, and in North Carolina, and all over the place. So I guess I'd like you to make the case that there really is overpopulation. I know that sounds a little odd, and it probably sounds odd to someone who works in the field and sees the numbers, but numbers don't tell us all that much in the way that someone who's immersed in the field understands the numbers do. So what's the case? How can you show us, how can you explain to us that there really is overpopulation in the world and that it's as serious as environmentalists want us to believe?
Well, right off the bat, with your North Dakota audience, and I realize people are going to be listening to this around the world, but a lot of people are hearing it out of their radios in North Dakota and Minnesota. And there, you're looking at a part of the world, the Great Plains, that has actually seen, in many counties, declining populations over the past 50 years.
That's right.
Unlike most of the country and many parts of the world, it's a harder intuitive argument to make to your listeners. But if they'll bear with me, I'm sure they've heard about various global environmental problems like climate change, number one, of course, worldwide species extinctions. Biologists tell us we've entered the sixth mass extinction of life on Earth since complex life evolved. We've got problems with excess nitrogen deposition and the acidification of the oceans. We've got problems with collapsing fisheries. Now, all of these have a population component. We have more pollution. We're overfishing areas because we have more people who are putting more economic demands on nature. So I would argue that those kind of problems show us that we have an overpopulation problem. Now, in terms of people looking out their windows and seeing wide open spaces, yeah, that's true. You can see that in many places. But a lot of the people listening to this broadcast will also know places that used to be wide open spaces that are no longer. There are plenty of places in North Dakota where if you'd gone out there 20 years ago, you would have been out on the prairie. And now you go out there and you're sort of in an industrialized landscape. There's oil wells and natural gas wells going on and intensive fracking. That too is a function of the sheer number of people who are making demands on energy resources.
So why can't we just relocate populations? Why can't we make another city in the Great Plains, take folks from Bangladesh and put them in China, and take some Chinese folks and find a way to put them in Brazil, in the more rural parts of Brazil? What's the problem with sort of rejiggering the system, shaking the globe a little bit and redistributing the people? Why can't we do that?
Well, we are doing it. I mean, some of these huge dam projects in India and China have moved literally millions of people in order.
And that's dam isn't stopping water. You're not cursing.
Right. Well, I am cursing, but it's a dam.
Yeah, yeah.
So, humanity is doing this. We're migrating in greater numbers than ever before. We're moving people for economic purposes more than ever before. Again, you have to ask yourself, what's the end game here? If the goal is to simply move people around to create better lives while still leaving sufficient resources for other species, that's one thing. If your goal is to just sort of keep the growth machine in all the balls up in the air for another couple of years, then it seems less sensible. And, to me, a new city on the Great Plains, I mean, that might or might not make sense. I don't know. But to me, one of the wonderful things about this world is that it's a diverse world. And one of the aspects of its diversity is there are some New York cities and some Chicagos, and there are some wide open plains and some Amazonian rainforest. And we're really going to lose a lot if we lose those places that are less the creation of people and more the creation of wild nature.
Well, and this goes to one of the issues that is throughout the book, and you yourself in your piece talk about this. And I'll admit that, given my own personal interest, this is the part of the book that interested me the most. You take a pretty strong stand against immigration. You want to limit immigration significantly into the United States. And then there's another author that takes a more cosmopolitan approach to limiting immigration. This is the part that I had the hardest time with. Isn't limiting immigration to minimize the population of the United States, isn't that interfering with the diversity, interfering with the cosmopolitan nature of the earth? Doesn't that violate the very premise of what our country is supposed to be?
Well, there are certainly trade-offs, and people would argue that limiting immigration would limit diversity. But again, there are some difficult trade-offs to be made here. I mean, for me, it was hard to come to the point where I argued in print for limiting immigration. My grandparents were immigrants to this country. I have plenty of friends who are immigrants. I see the real value in immigration, in driving diversity, in giving people opportunities. At the same time, I really don't see the creation of a sustainable United States with two or three times as many people. At current immigration levels of about 1.25 million people coming in annually to the United States, we're on track to double our population in 100 years. I just don't see the U.S. creating a sustainable society and still doubling our population. So to my mind, we have to choose between those two things, and I choose for sustainability, I choose to keep some of our country still wild. But, I admit that it's a trade-off.
But how do you – and maybe this is an unfair question because you're not a public policy person, but how do you make that choice? How do you decide who comes and who doesn't, right? I mean, the immigration policy of the United States in the 1930s limited the amount of Jews and caused tremendous disaster we all know about. I mentioned on the show before that my father just recently got married to a Mongolian woman who now thankfully has a green card. Are we going to say to him, well, you're not allowed to love, you're not allowed to have a family? What happens if when your sons grow up, they have a romantic partner who comes from Sweden or Nairobi? How do we make the decision that these people, my father, your son, the Jewish refugees, we're not going to take you. We're not going to let you have the life that some people feel you have the right to have. How do we make that choice?
Well, I think we start by understanding, again, that there are trade-offs. So we're making a choice right now. I mentioned that we have about 1.25 million immigrants coming into the U.S. annually. We could have 2 or 3 times that many, but we limit it. So we're already making choices about who can come and who can't come. Then if you accept that idea that, you know, we have to make choices about these things, then, again, you have to make some hard choices. You can say, as we do in the United States, well, we're going to let most of our slots for newcomers go to family reunification. But then you're going to be flooding labor markets with relatively less educated, relatively less skilled workers. And that has an impact in driving down wages for working class Americans and driving up economic inequality. Other countries like Canada and Australia put much more of an emphasis on bringing in immigrants who are highly skilled and more educated. So that has different implications. But in all these cases, you're going to have trade-offs. But, you know, if you really want to explore this immigration issue, I've got a new book coming out on this, University of Chicago Press. It's coming out at the end of this year, focused on immigration policy. So you should have me back and we can talk about it more.
I would like that. And I do want to push you, though, because this question, you know, you say, well, this current immigration policy brings in less educated, less skilled population. This brings the labor rates down, et cetera, et cetera. But isn't that precisely the people that this country was built to bring? I mean, aren't you, in essence, by making these claims, forcing a kind of global inequality, reinforcing the rich country, poor country divide? And aren't you picking and choosing people who are more or less valuable? I mean, as someone who, again, this is my personal interest, but as someone who has paid a little bit of attention to this and who this matters to, I hear the language you're using and I hear value judgments about who is more important, who is less important, who gets rights and who doesn't, and which countries are going to remain rich and which countries are going to remain poor. Is there any way to deal with overpopulation without making these fundamental judgments about the value of other people and the utilitarian value of other people to the country that they are moving to? What happened to this notion that we want to decrease global inequality, we want all people to have an equal opportunity to life and success? How do we do that? I mean, obviously this is what makes it controversial, but this is a serious question. How do we do this without labeling people as invaluable?
Well, careful now. I wasn't really saying that some people were less valuable than others. All I was saying was that the U.S. and Canada have two different immigration policies, and one of them helps certain people more, and the other helps other people more, and they have different societal impacts. I wasn't saying that one of those was better than the other.
But you have to choose. I mean, that's your point. You have to choose.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Someone is going to have to make that decision.
Well, yeah. And the problem is, in the United States, we really haven't had a great discussion about, number one, what are the impacts of immigration environmentally, economically? And two, we really haven't made choices about that in the interest of the common good. So in lieu of that, what you have are special interests. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce lobbies very hard to flood labor markets because they want to give capital the benefit over labor. So, you know, they know what they're arguing for, but progressives really don't know what we're arguing for. At least that's my argument in this book. The book is actually subtitled The Progressive Argument for Reducing Immigration into the United States. And in there, I go into some detail about just how harsh the impacts of half a century of mass immigration have been on the labor movement, on driving down wages for poorer Americans.
This is an interesting point to stop only because it leaves 1,001 questions on the table. But what it also does is highlight how obviously integrated these issues are. So, Phil, I want to thank you so much for a really interesting conversation and a challenging one that gives us a whole agenda of things to think about in the future.
Great talking with you, Jack. Thanks so much for having me on.
You've been listening to Phil Cafaro and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We've been talking about environmentalism and overpopulation, and I'll be back with some thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We were talking with Phil Cafaro and asking whether or not there are too many people for our environment. And to steal a phrase from almost every cop movie now and to clean it up a little bit, stuff just got real. That's the problem we face on this discussion. If Phil is right, if the environmentalists are right, if there is too many people, if there are too many people in the world, and if the next generation is going to lead to utter decimation, then we have no choice. We have to do something. And what that something means is either reduce consumption, reduce what we use, or reduce the amount of people, or, as some would suggest, and I think Phil suggests, both. We have to do both. How do we do that? How do we decide who gets fewer TVs, who gets less food, who gets less land, who has fewer kids, who doesn't get the rights and the freedoms and the liberties that they want? Thankfully, I'm not a public policy person. I am a philosopher, and Phil's a philosopher. And so we get to ask questions and point out the key moments that are really important. And in the process, Phil said a couple things. The first thing he suggested is that most women don't want to have 12 kids. That when you present women around the world with free and easy accessible contraception, that they have smaller families. Now, this is an interesting thing because it suggests that we don't necessarily want to be overpopulated. We just are through social expectation, through political organization, through pressure, and through limited rights. We are overpopulated because women who bear children are expected or pressured to have more children than they want. Now, this isn't true of everybody. Obviously, there are some women who want to have 23 kids. That's fine. But the first thing that he brought up is that there's more choice involved. The second thing that he brought up is that there really is an objective standard for overpopulation, that the amount of devastation that we are engaged in right now and the amount of destruction that's happening shows beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is overpopulation. We can't just move people around. Maybe we could for a couple years. But as he said, there's no end game. But what's interesting to me, and I think what is actually really helpful, is what happens when you start talking about immigration and limiting populations and limiting movements. And what happens is that you get folks on the left arguing for the same things on the right. You get the argument that we should limit immigration, that we should focus on the common good, that we should care about the community at times more than just individuals. And this can show that our left-right distinction is incoherent, but what it also can show, which is actually much more optimistic, is that in the end, the great philosophical problems actually end up having consensus. In the end, the great philosophical issues that divide us can actually unify us in ways that we wouldn't think possible. So the left and the right may want to limit immigration. They may do it for different reasons, but nevertheless, they agree on it. The left and the right agree that community is important. They may agree on it for different reasons, but they do it anyway. There's a moment in Phil's book that we didn't talk about where he cites Jesus's condemnation of materialism and consumption. Phil self-describes himself as a progressive, and yet he uses a conservative religious argument to limit consumption and to save us from overpopulation and environmental degradation. This is a wonderful moment because it shows us that we are all in the same place. We are all in the same boat, and we can all agree, even if we come from different places. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein, Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, and as always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower,